Hi, I'm Bob. I'm an alcoholic.
Bob.
Served through the grace of God in AA since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. It's already been a good weekend. I mean, it's been very cool. I love when you're a talker, you need someone to talk to. When you're a pitcher, you need someone to catch. And this particular conference, along with many of the Woodstock conferences, people are, they're easier to talk into because, you know, they're in the game. It's, you know, we're players. We're talking to each other as we progress through this process. And it's a privilege to be here. When Mildred talked about the ABCs at the end where it says, God couldn't, what if you ever saw it? One of the great questions is how much time have you spent seeking God? And I'm not always very satisfied with my answer when I ask that question to myself, but that's who I think is in this room. I don't think in this room is, I think it's a little different than the average roundup or conference that you go to. I think the people here are seeking, and as a result of that, it's an easier person to talk to. Mildred, you were wonderful. When I first met you, which you would not remember, you were still drinking. I was in Prince Albert with Chuck and Elsa and Johnny and Dottie. Dottie gave her first AA talk at that conference. And boy, were you something. Hot is the word that comes to mind. But Cecil and Mac and Tom, they were our heroes. I mean, they were, you know, Mac Cheater was an extraordinary man, kind of the Chamberlain in some ways of Canada. And those were good times. I was only sober a few years, and I got turned on to conferences, and I went up to Prince Albert, and that was like drinking out of a fire hose that weekend. Enjoy Clancy. I enjoy his talk. He's one of the most unique people that you would run into. He's the most copied, least copyable person I've ever met. And but it's also as who he's become for us, you know. And there's something in that that I like and enjoy. I'm going to talk about 4, 5, and 6. Kind of a funny combination. And when I got into doing some preparation for this, I just got stuck in 1, 2, and 3. I mean, it's really funny. You get into the book, and it's all... Someone was said the Bible was written with the idea that Christ is going to come back at any moment to be ready and prepare. And the big book is written like we're new, like we've come in, like we've just surrendered. I would put forth the idea that I don't know. I always just say when I surrendered. I think it's more accurate to say when we were surrendered. Mildred did such a great job of describing the barrenness of the situation preceding surrender. In Mel Barger's book, My Search for Bill W., and he has that wonderful letter that Bill wrote him when he was sober about 3 years, and he's writing Bill to ask him about his spiritual awakening and ask him why the 12 and 12 is so different than the big book. And Bill wrote back and said, you know, he's writing to a newcomer, a four-page letter, you know, which is, you know, just astounding, very personal information, talking about his depression, talking about his struggle over the, you know, he had just come out of the depression about the time that he's writing this. But he said, you know, people make a big deal out of my spiritual awakening. But he said, I think everybody in AA is offered and gets the same thing. If you were to take all the cumulative spiritual experiences that you've had in your years in Alcoholics Anonymous and compress them into 6 minutes, you too would see the sun and the stars. And it is, for most of us, it is handed to us a teaspoon at a time. And most of us don't see it while we're in it. It's just incremental. But the accumulation of that is profound. I'm going to hop back and forth a little bit. I'm just going to initially brush through what the book talks about in 4 and 5, because I think most of us are familiar with the structure of 4 and 5. And then I'll come back and talk about what I think the difficulties are for me today in 4 and 5. The journey we're about to take in the fourth and fifth step, I heard someone not too long ago talk about the first three steps are to give up. 4 and 5 are to own up. 6 through 9 are to clean up. And 10, 11, and 12 are to grow up. So now I've gone from giving up, okay, and at that point, and when Bill talks about preceding is in the letter when he talked about, I think when the ego is suppressed, which is what the appropriate depression that most of us are in when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, the circumstances, we're in the paradigm of survival and the circumstances of our life are dire. And at that point in time, we don't have many conditions. We are, broken. And as a friend of mine said, we're broken open. And in that opening, Bill talks about the inrush of grace that can come through, which, and Clancy talked about the plastic shell that most of us exist in. Most of us are eggs. There's no entry point. Everybody's been trying to help us say the things that we need to hear, and we haven't been willing or able to hear any of them until we were able and ready to hear. And we're broken open. And now, after that surrender experience, where someone would have caught us in a bar and started an argument about God, about being powerless, about coming to believe in power greater than yourself, in, making a decision to turn your life over to the care of God, after we gagged, we just wouldn't have any of it. We wouldn't have any of it. One of the lines in the book, just at the fourth step, when it talked about it, it says, we're sick spiritually and emotionally and physically. But it says once we get well spiritually, we start to get well emotionally and physically. I said, that's backwards. It always seemed, I said, well, first we get, when I was a young guy when I came in, and first you get well physically, then you get well emotionally, and spirituality is the most sophisticated aspect of the program. That's last. And I no longer believe that. I believe what the book says. Something happens that allowed me to be able to go to the meetings, to be able to read the book, to be able to ask for help, to be able to get a sponsor, to be able to try the steps. I wouldn't have, that wouldn't have been available to me on any basis. But something happened to me without any conscious effort on my part that I did that all of a sudden made that of some interest to me and something I was willing to do at some level, somewhat restricted given the fact that I was young and new. So the book is just full of descriptions explaining to us that we can't do it to ourselves, that we're powerless. I mean, it's calls it a malady, an illness, an obsession, an allergy of the body, an obsession of the mind. Why we're alcoholic, it's a riddle. The main problem centers in our mind, not our bodies. We've lost control. The degree that you can get well on your own is dependent upon to the extent that you're lost of control. Okay. And now we're going to talk about, so I'm going to talk about it as a new person when I came in. So now we're presented with the fourth step, freshly coming out of 1, 2, and 3. And the book says, being convinced, as Mildred talked about, being convinced of what? That we're powerless, that we could not manage our own lives, that we were alcoholic, no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, God couldn't, what if you saw it? So now I'm going to go through a process of vigorous action, and I'm going to go through a process of cleaning house, which I think the brilliance of the program, it isn't just like most other things where it really gets you in a course of believing things, gives you what to believe. We're entering a process, and all those promises we made to start over, well, the next morning it just looked impossible. I mean, we have, what about all the bad checks? What about the lost job? What am I going to, the mountain of things that we had to deal with early in recovery was just so oppressive that on our own, most of us could not attend to it at all. And now we're starting a process that we don't know anything about and we're really doing because we're being asked to do it or told to do it because it's the next step in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says to us that self is the issue. We have to be rid of self or it'll kill us. And then it says we're going to take a look at the manifestations of self, the three or four that the book focuses on more than anything else are resentments or anger, fear, and sex. And then it goes through and it gives us an organization to be able to talk about who we're resentful at, why we're resentful at them, what the impact on us was, whether it's pride or our esteem or our security or our relationships. And then it later in the book, depending upon what your attitude is, and I think it was an idea that was really kind of called the fourth column by Joe and Charlie. I think that phrase actually was coined by Joe and Charlie. And it talks about that we look for our part, our mistakes. Where were we, you know, angry, dishonest, self-seeking, you know. And that's where Bill slipped in the four absolutes. Those are the opposite of the absolutes. You know, he really tried to tone down what the content of the Oxford group. But in that particular space where the fourth column, when he's asking us, those are the opposites of the virtues of purity, honesty, and selfishness and love. And then we go through that list, and then we do a fear inventory, and then we do a sex inventory. A fear inventory was something that escaped me for the longest time. I think I was so afraid I wasn't able to inventory it. I mean, I have no other explanation of why the fear inventory was not very important to me and not very effective and not done or not done well until I was into my third or fourth inventory. Sex is a problem. I think sex is, you know, he said we wouldn't be alive if we didn't have, you know, all of us that are alive have sexual issues. And it's an overemphasized part of life. At its worst, it's toxic and chronic. But for most of us, somewhere between the two curbs of none and too much, eventually what it says, we really deal with it like we deal with anything else. And when through prayer we ask for a new model, a new standard, a new ideal that we can go into relationships with. So little by slowly, in this process of the fourth and fifth step, we're introducing the idea. You know, the motto, the mantra of the ego, it's not my fault. I'm not to blame. The ego is the blamer. It knows what's wrong with everybody else. The angrier we are, the more responsibility it gives someone else. I'm not to blame. It's not my fault. The fourth step says, it's your fault. It may not be all your fault, but it's enough your fault. You know, you were not a person who lost your keys and the big people picked it up and robbed a bank and used your car as a getaway car. You were not remotely connected to the chaos in your life and the pain in your life and the pain that it caused other people. We were intimately involved in that process. But most of us come in here with a really strong story. And in that story, you know, when the judge says guilty or not guilty, when the commanding officer says guilty, guilty with explanation, Your Honor. You know, there's always an explanation. There's always a reason. There's always, you know, none of us do evil, on purpose. But we have some sort of rationale that puts it in. You know, if I'm going to steal, you know, a couple of $100 out of Dick's wallet sitting on the counter, I'm going to go through some process that, even if it's a snap, unexplainable process. I go through some process that allows me to pick that wallet up when he's in the shower and take the $200 bill out of it, which I did time after time after time with my father to do that. So these are, I don't know, the wisdom and the beauty of the order of the steps and the process that it takes us through. And in that process, it sneaks in the idea of forgiveness, which is absolutely essential. It starts to talk about it as the idea that we need to forgive the people that harmed us, that perhaps they're sick. Perhaps we would treat them with the same kindness we would a sick friend. We pray for them. It starts to give us an idea of forgiveness as something that's available to us, something that, I mean, when you're in survival, forgiveness never even shows up. You know, if you were doing your own dictionary, it wouldn't even be in your dictionary because you're in survival. It doesn't, you don't have anything extra to give. I'm in 6-foot waves hanging onto a hunk of wood. You know, give me a break. I'm going to take care of someone else. Everything that I need needs to attend to me in my survival. And we have to, over a period of time, we start to break that paradigm of survival and get into the participation of life. But while you're in that paradigm, there is nothing else. When you talk about the selfishness of the person who comes in new, I mean, that's all there is. There is not, we have nothing left over to give anybody. So they sneak in the idea of forgiveness. And when we start to go in from 4 to 5, all of a sudden it occurs to us that we might be forgiven. At our worst, many of us feel like we're unforgivable, when there isn't any such thing as unforgivable. You know, the grace of God, the forgiveness of God, the love of God transcends anything that we would make up in our own mind. But because most of us have been exposed and churched in some sort of thing and developed, in some cases, very strong ideas about God, and most of those ideas are limiting. They're about the judgment of God. They're about the, you know, and that to really make life okay, for us to be okay, we have to behave in the way that God would have us behave. Anybody here able to do that? Okay, we do it better than we used to do it, but I don't know anybody. I don't know anybody who does it at a level where they're knocking it all the way out of the park. And I know some pretty astounding people. One of the great things about us is that we have an ongoing conversation about inventory in our lives, so that it isn't a person who's been cured talking down to someone who still has the problem. It's a fellow traveler who may be further down the road, but having a conversation about, yeah, when I was in third grade, you know, I remember that problem that I had. You know, now I'm in high school, and I see it a little bit differently. Let me tell you what happened to me. And we share it from a process that we're students in the game, that we go do that. And it's, but I don't know that there's another time. I think when I said the steps assume that we're new, the steps assume that we're surrendered, the steps assume that we're convinced. With the ego suppressed, it's probably the most open we have ever been in a hell of a long time to be able to stand naked in front of our alcoholism. When you stand naked in front of it, when they say the truth will set you free, well, first it will piss you off. But mostly it will scare the dickens out of you. Most of us would not voluntarily would avoid that. But it's unavoidable. If you're going to take the steps and you're going to go through the process, this is one of the great rites of passage. One of the great rites of passage is the first step, and the fourth and fifth step are one of the next great rite of passage. Not discounting 2 and 3. It's really interesting to me when you read the literature and you hear them talk about when they were having the meetings at T. Henry's and Clarice Williams' house. In order to attend the meeting down, so they had an Oxford group. This was the drunk squad of the Oxford group meeting in the Williams House in Akron, Ohio. But in order to attend the downstairs meeting, you had to go upstairs and make a decision. Now, in the common vernacular, make a decision, give me a break. Okay, I decided. I mean, it would be just a nothing, a throwaway. Okay, I decide. No, but it's go up, get on your knees, and decide. And many people think the decision was to go through with the next steps of the program, but at that time there were no next steps of the program. We only had 6. You know, we had surrender, inventory, confession, amends, working with others, and complete dependence on a power greater than yourself. Those were the six steps that Bill fleshed out, and through, you know, inner depression, sitting in his bed with his imaginary ulcers and a legal pad, and he wrote out the 12 steps. What a gift. What a channel that man was. I mean, you know, what a channel that man was. Humility, as Bill says, is the basis of all the steps. And there's a lot of different definitions of humility. Being able to see yourself as you are, being able to see yourself as you are and be willing to become what you can become. In my reading of this, I took two ideas of two different people and put them together, and it said, number one, that we have to be able to see and understand our defects of character. Number two, be willing to tell them to someone else. And number three, be willing to change them. And I think that's a definition or description of humility that really applies to the process that we are in as we go through this recovery. Would you, Lee, you give me a 50-minute warning or something like that? I forgot where I was. In step 6 and 7, so I'm talking about as a new person coming in. Step 6 and 7, step 6, not 7, I ignored. It just seemed, Linda humorously says she thought 6 and 7 were kind of filler steps. You know, they needed 12, and so they threw in 6 and 7 because, you know, I mean, you've given up, you've surrendered, you've turned yourself into Alcoholics Anonymous. You start to go through this step process. You do an inventory, which, you know, is a pretty dicey situation for most of us. And then you sit down with another person and you admit to yourself, to God, and another human being the exact nature of your wrongs. Are you entirely ready? I've never been more ready in my mind, at that moment. So my answer was, of course. You're entirely ready to have God remove your difficulty? Yep. Ask him? Yep. Done. Done. So my first inventory did not get to the causes and conditions. I'm a 20 fun, you know, I just turned 24 by a week. I'm doing an inventory. I often wondered why my inventory wasn't very deep. My life wasn't very deep. At 24 years old, I wasn't married. I didn't have a career. I was just, you know, I screwed up everything I could put my hands on. I hurt everybody who was connected to me in significant ways in my life. I drank enough as a 24-year-old to have an enlarged liver when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had some consequences and conditions, few arrests, car accidents, all the sorts of things that you do. But mostly it was just how poorly I thought of myself. I was just as tired of being a jerk as I could, you know, and I just couldn't get out of the damn paradigm. And so I did the inventory to the best of my ability, and really what it was a recitation of the worst things that I had done. And did my, you know, but I still came away from that fifth step with a sense of hope and with a sense of forgiveness. Otherwise, why the hell would I do it? I mean, it was very, I come from a tradition where we have confession. Some of the core ideas of that were familiar to me, and I came away with that idea that I had some forgiveness and I had the opportunity to change. And from the moment I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and was listening to the men and women talk about it, I had a sense that I wanted what they had, that something profoundly had altered their lives. And I came on an increasing basis to believe that this problem that I had was a problem that they had. I dropped some of the uniqueness that I had when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. As I continued to stay sober, I did another fourth and fifth step when I was sober about 3 years. But the best fourth and fifth step I think I've ever taken, I did when I was 7-plus years of sobriety. I was, in my AA talk, you've heard me say that, you know, I mean, I had a gambling problem, I had an anger problem, you know, I was inappropriately physical with my children, I was a money spender. You know, I had problems getting to work, staying at work, and working at work. I was an inattentive father and an inattentive husband. I was stark raving sober. I didn't want to miss anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife was seeing less of me when in our early married life, you know, than because I'm in AA. You know, I'm either busy not working or I'm, you know, in the program. I had all those issues when I took my first four step, and none of the issues I just mentioned to you made my first four step. I mean, how astounding is that, that none of the issues I just shared with you made my first four step? A few of them made my second four step. But by the time I'm 7 years sober, I'm inured to this idea that AA is going to cure me. I mean, I came in here and I thought, finally, I found something that's going to help me not be a horse's ass. This explains why I've had the difficulties in my life. These people have a program, an answer, and I've got a sponsor and I've got help, and it's going to be okay. And then you start trying to not gamble. Then you start trying to change your work life. Then you start trying to change your sex life. Then you start changing how you're bouncing checks around. And, you know, you do a little bit better here, a little bit better there, but the pattern was downward. And you get to 3 or 4 years, and they're starting to bother. You know, I didn't have a very good list of my defects of character in my first year, year and a half. I was on a honeymoon. Second year, I started to get a list. Third year, they're bothering me. Fourth year, they're really bothering me. Fifth, sixth, and seventh, they're eating my lunch. I came into AA, had a wall built around me, didn't let you see what I didn't want you to see. You like me. You only like what I let you see about me. If you could see everything, you'd hate me. I hate me. So, you know, I knew what I looked like from the inside, and so I just tried to my very level best to show you what I wanted you to see. I just went from pleasing the people on the street to pleasing the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And brick by brick, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I built I tore the wall down, and I did the best of my ability, as poor as it was in my four step. And I shared my life to the best of my ability with my sponsor. I did the first two steps with clergy, which is how we were instructed to do them. But now I'm sober in AA, very active, sponsoring people. I'm the wingman of Warren. He's the most active guy in our group, and I got to be his wingman. And my life is going downward. I'm on the down escalator, running my butt off, going up, and I feel like everybody else is doing better than I'm doing. The guys I'm sponsoring are doing better than I'm doing. And this is, so what am I faced with? I'm faced with the story of my life. Great, my mother always said, "You're not very bright, Bob, dress well." She didn't say exactly that, but it was very close to that. She had a tongue like a razor blade. So I showed you what you wanted to see, and now I'm sober and I'm just scared crapless that I start well. I'm a guy that you'd pick on your team. I'm a guy that you'd want on your team, unless you knew me well. You might, if you knew me briefly, you'd want me on your team. But if you knew my pattern is I do great for a brief period of time, and over a long period of time, I'm not a team player. Or I'm not a team accomplisher. Okay. And when I got to 7 years of sobriety with the wall built back up, thank you very much for helping my drinking problem, stay out of my sex life, stay out of my marriage, stay out of my parenting, stay out of my money spending, stay out of my gambling, stay out of my work. Brick by brick, I'm telling my sponsor 65% of what's going on. I know you guys do 100. But we're only telling ourselves 65% of what's going on. You don't see it when you're in it. Life is lived forward but understood backwards. It isn't until you've passed through that you can start to see not only the content of what was there, but the impact and consequences on our life. In the 7.5 years of sobriety, and it was really funny because Linda and I both had a breakdown at that time. And I used to think, I felt so badly about being such a lame member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it is my experience that somewhere between 5 and 15 years, most of us have a second surrender experience where we get an opportunity to deepen the steps in our lives. When I came in, I stood naked in front of my alcoholism, and it changed me. And I gave Alcoholics Anonymous what I thought my alcoholism was. You know, if I didn't give them my sex life, and I didn't give them my gambling, and I tried and work and those sorts of things. But at 7.5 years, I stood naked in front of my life. And it wasn't very attractive. And it was like an inventory got shoved at me through a fire hose. And I saw myself with a clarity and an honesty that I had been unwilling or unable to see myself with a clarity and honesty. And I went through the steps for the third time formally. And, you know, 1, 2, and 3 were as obvious as the first step was very obvious. Powerless and unmanageable. The second step I had lost. I didn't believe it for me. I believed it for you. I believed it for Ralph. I believed it for Joe, but I didn't believe it for me. I had to regain the second step because I'm busting my ass. I'm going to 5 or 6 meetings and sponsoring. I got all the merit badges. You know, when they pick the team, I've got more merit badges than most young people that are around in our group. But I'm going down. I'm sinking. And I think when you're in trouble, you have better eyes and you start to see people with bigger problems with smiles on their face walking through the walls that I was trying to avoid with dignity and grace, and you come to believe that God will restore you to sanity. Took my third step on my knees with my sponsor. And when I did the fourth step at 7.5 years, everything was included. All the arenas of my life. I find when I go back and do, and I've done many fourth and fifth steps, I find today that the categories of, and I can make the categories work, but the categories of resentment, sex, fear, and no longer are as meaningful to me in my day-to-day experience as they were when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have many resentments. The resentments I have was interesting to have Mildred talk about, you know, Dora and the childhood and the family and the line in the book when we talk about resentments, when it goes up there and it talks about remorse and it says, then we're sore at ourselves. As I get older, remorse is one of the biggest things that sits on my shoulder. I wish I had done that differently with my parents, with my aunt, with my, you know, grandma, with the different, you clean up what you can clean up, but with, you know, and it's like looking back, you have to be careful about that when you go back and do that, because most of the time it's maudlin, it is not healthy, it is a neurotic, unspiritual sort of thing. But at 7 years, I did a new inventory, and I did my fifth step with my sponsor. He sent me to a psychologist. He said, you've got a lot of issues around work, money, fear, and success, and failure. I want you to go talk to a psychologist who works with people in business, and then I want you to bring that conversation back to me. And what I discovered, and he wanted my wife involved, which was a hard thing for me, because when your wife's in the room, you got a different conversation when you're in the room alone. One of the great exercises I always, when you get to 6 and 7, when I talk about it, if you got a guy that's, or gal that's really having trouble with the columns, just say, look, don't worry about the columns. They get confusing. I want you to get your ex-wife and your wife, your brothers and sisters, your ex-in-laws, your current in-laws, your employer and your ex-employer, and a couple of guys in the group and your sponsor, and I want you to get them in a room. And I want you to say, we have a step in Alcoholics Anonymous where we try to get in touch with our defects of character, and I'm having trouble identifying mine. Okay. Even as a mental exercise, if you were to put your wife in a chair and face that chair and write down what you think your wife would say about you. If you would put your mother or your father or your best friend and write down what they would say about you, it would surprise you what you have access to in the recesses of your brain. So I went to the psychologist, and what I got in touch with as a psychologist was fear. And it was astounding to me. Chamberlain used to talk about, you know, the two fishes in the ocean, and the one fish looks over to the other fish and says, "Isn't the ocean wonderful?" And the other fish looks over and says, "What's the ocean?" I was swimming in fear. I was afraid of being a husband, father, worker. I was afraid of failure. I was afraid of success. I was just, you know, swimming in fear and didn't know it. My life altered, turned on a dime when I was sitting in my living room one night, understanding that I had done the very best I knew how to do, and I had failed. And I was given the opportunity to take the 6 and the 7 step at a level that I had never occurred to me to take them. And I became entirely ready to have God remove defects of character. Subsequent to that evening, I put a structure in place to change my life with help. Went to my sponsor, made appointments about when I'd go to work, what I'd try to do at work, how long I'd stay at work. I quit gambling that night, started dating my wife that night. I went to a psychologist to get help with parenting. I just, all of a sudden, whatever barriers or boundaries or impediments or... And I think what's so hard... I think that many of us, when we go to our first, fourth, and fifth step, as hard as that is, it's easier because we're talking about the consequences of our use. We spend the first number of years in AA kind of cleaning up the consequences of our addiction. But when, as time goes on, and you're not dealing with just those consequences, you start to deal with essential characteristics of yourself, which are harder to admit to than a car accident, than I was inappropriately sexually, but I was drunk, and, you know, all those sorts of things are things that we did. And now we're going to have a conversation about who we are. And it's easier to talk about what I did than who I am. And most of us have built this identity, this ego, this false self. Most of us have a story that is so, that explains where we are and why we are. And let me tell you, and if you ever open up the opportunity to have someone start their story, I mean, you've got yourself an hour and a half without any prodding whatsoever, because there's a lot of velocity behind that. Now, when you're asked to alter that, when it's suggested to you that maybe you don't see it the way it is, that maybe your viewpoint that you've been building since you've been a kid, maybe your agenda for happiness, maybe the way you get esteem, maybe the way you get control, maybe the way you get security is what's balling this thing up. You built your toolkit, and it just might be entirely full of hammers. When all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And you start working with the steps, start working with your sponsor, and somewhere after a couple of years, he lifts off the top tray. Under the top tray are some screwdrivers and wrenches. And life starts to take on a little different turn. This is an immense journey. I mean, a journey from someone who, for resentments and anger, were the dominant issues that we have to deal with as we go through our fourth step, and where we end up in 9 and 10, or 8 and 9, making amends to the very same people, the almost identically those two lists. If someone would have told us when we started step 4 that the grudge list was going to end up being the amends list, I mean, how many of us would have believed that, number one, or done it? I mean, why? I mean, you know, the person harmed me. What the hell am I? I mean, I'm not to blame. You obviously didn't hear me. Let me go through this again. Okay. That we're going to forgive them, let them out of jail, no longer be right, but be related. We're going to give up those kind of goodies, our tools, as we go through that? Hell no. But that's the process, that in a relatively brief period of time, you're going to walk from your grudge list to your amends list. You're going to go from hate and anger to forgiveness. You're going to go from the idea that these are who I am, you know, from who I am to maybe I can be forgiven and maybe I can change. It is a hell of a deal. The two biggest in that change is one of the biggest. It's like a sex change operation. It is not like an improvement. It is literally of a dimension that is almost unholdable. If you were to say that, our minds could not get that. One of the other main changes and transformations that happened in Alcoholics Anonymous, Clancy talked about it a little, is we go, if you talk to most brand new people, and you get to know them well enough that they will talk freely with you, if you ask them how they are and how's it going, in many cases they do the dump. You know, and the dump is all the things that aren't working that they're afraid of, that, you know, it's the IRS, it's my checking account, it's my student loans, it's my, you know, it's my debt, it's my credit cards, it's my ex-wife, it's my wife, it's the court, it's my employer, it's my ex, you know, it is the things, the circumstances, the dire, the external aspect, the detritus of our lives. And then one day you ask them how they are, and they say, "Oh, I'm okay. I was a little nuts on Tuesday, but I'm okay." Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed, but something's changed, because they answered the question very differently than they answered it when they did the dump. And the other conversation that changed, we come in here with a toxic, fatal, internal dialogue. The hell's wrong with us internally that we need a pint or a fifth a day to deal with the angst that we have that make life okay? Something's wrong. And when you stop drinking, that's not gone. That's present. We need something, as Mildred talked about, you know, between us and it. We need something to deal with. When Bill says we're going to go back in the fourth step and we're going to take a look at the unworkability of our lives and the thing that caused our alcoholism and caused our failure. And when Silkworth said to him, "When you know, you need to be grounded in an idea that's bigger than you are, in a power that's greater than you are. If you are to recreate your life," which is what Jung said, the fundamental core ideas that were, you know, of a person's life were suddenly cast aside. And Silkworth says, the same people who just tried like mad and were unable to do it, all of a sudden, easily. I mean, that's what have those spiritual words is, you know, someone once asked Anthony DeMello, you know, is enlightenment slow or fast? He said, both. It's both. And those of us in the program would not deny that. You get these little jerks upward, you know, where they're just, you know, really boosts to the deal, but, you know, much of it is very much incremental over a period of time. So how the hell do I find myself in sober and Alcoholics Anonymous at 7 years or at 48 years next week, still having significant defects of character? And what do I do about it? The answer, most of us who are sitting sober in this room have had the most profound experience to the answer to that question that you could possibly have. You had an addiction. You had an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. Once you drank, you couldn't stop drinking. Once you stopped, you couldn't stay stopped. And we were caught into a thing that we literally donated every worthwhile piece of our lives to that process, and something happened. And we changed. And the change was significant enough that it wasn't just a change, we called it a transformation. We are a different person. When Bill looked at Ebby, It wasn't just that Ebbie was clean. He saw something, and isn't it amazing today? I mean, and today, would he still refer to Ebbie as a sponsor? Hell no. I mean, Ebbie got drunk. Bill referred to Ebbie as a sponsor his entire life. Why? I think the gratitude that Bill was very clear that Ebbie was a channel through which Bill got the message. That level, Bill was a very loyal guy. He helped Silkworth financially after Silkworth was having problems. And he was loyal to Ebbie all the way through. And there was a little fund that they all got together that, you know, kind of helped Ebbie stay together the last 5 or 6 years in that home that he was in. But I think Bill knew that the universe used Ebbie to bring him the message. And what more could someone do than to do that? The reason, so first of all, none of us get rid of all our defects of character. Let's settle that right now. We're not having a conversation about getting good. But we do get good. Our lives do clean up. We are not, you know, we are the same people. And I remember when Chamberlain sat me down in a room one time and he said, son, you already are everything you're ever going to be. You're as wonderful as you're ever going to be. He says, I can tell you're disappointed by that. I said, hell. A dozen of us gathered up in his room at his feet. I said, hell, I don't even understand it. And he said, the man in the street committing rape right now, these are rough words in this modern age, is doing the best he knows how to do. When he has more light, he will do better. When he has more light. Having had a spiritual awakening, rather than sleepwalking through our lives, we incrementally get more light. And once you're awake, you can no longer strike a child, gamble when you're supposed to work, you know. But the reason that most of us have conflicts, the reason that most of us don't have the full measure is because we're conflicted. If I asked you the question, would you like to get rid of all your defects of character that are hurting you and the important people in your life, almost everybody would answer yes to that question. And then we would ask, well, you're sober 20 years, you're sober 10 years, you're sober 7 years. Why aren't they gone? Because I want both. I want my defects of character, and I want the symptom to go away. I want relief, not a cure. In liquid manure, up to your nose in a vat, your sponsor says, can I help you out? You say, no, I'm okay. Just get that person over there to stop making waves. you know, it's a I'm going to tell my other favorite joke. I'm going to tell two jokes. Lady goes to a doctor. And the doctor says, can I help you? She says, yeah. She says, I got a problem. What's wrong? She says, well, I'm passing gas. You can't hear it and you can't smell it, but I have this sensation and it bothers the heck out of me and I wish you'd give me something for it. So the doctor gives her a prescription and says, come back in a week and we'll talk about it. Lady comes back in a week and the doctor says, how is your problem now? She says, it's worse. And he says, what do you mean? He says, now you can smell it. He said, well, good. Now that we have your nose cleared up, we can work on your hearing. I promise you that the important people in your life can smell and hear quite well. And the other one is about a minister sitting on a park bench waiting for a bus down at the bottom of a hill. The top of a hill is a 10-year-old kid on a bicycle, and the kid comes down the hill, and the bike gets out of control, and he goes head over tea kettle and, you know, bends the wheel of the bike, tears his pant leg, cuts his leg, and he gets up and he says, "Son of a bitch." And the minister said, "Son, don't talk like that." He said, "The next time you have a very difficult situation, I want you to stand up and say, 'Jesus, help me.'" 6 months later, same minister, same kid. The kid comes down the hill. The bike's out of control. He falls head over tea kettle, bends the wheel, tears his pants, cuts his leg. And he gets up and he says, "Jesus, help me." And his cut cleans up, his pants come together, and the wheel straightens out. And the minister says, "Son of a bitch." It is. Why do we keep going to these conferences? Why do we keep listening to the talks? I mean, it's the same. But it's like the story of Christmas. It's like, "Tell me again, Daddy, what happened. Tell me." It is an encouragement. It's a soul-feeding sort of thing that remind me of how powerful this is. Remind me that I don't know. Remind me that I don't see. Open myself up enough that I'm willing to see. And that's what the last vestiges, many of the issues, when Bill talks about we have to get down to causes and conditions, so many, when Mildred talked about it so well, there are ways, psychologically, psychiatrically, through psychoanalysis, which I went through, there are ways through spirituality, through meditation. But there's something that happens to us cumulatively. When Keating talks about centering prayer, he talks about meditation. He talks about that there's a healing in play. He talks about meditation as prayer beyond words, of being present to what I would say is God. And in that process, in the no-word process, in moments of and we keep thinking meditation is going to be the absence of thinking, but most of us, when we go to meditation, do not have the absence of thinking. What we have to do is detach ourselves in that process, sink to the bottom of the river and grab the weeds and let the boats go by. He would say in that process, there's a healing of our subconscious. We talk an awful lot about what we're aware of. If I were to draw a circle and said, "This circle is everything there is to know. This piece of the pie is what you know. This next piece of the pie is what you don't know. The rest of the pie is what you don't know and don't know you don't know." Almost everything of significance that we learn in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, for many of us, comes from the section of the pie that we didn't know and didn't know we didn't know it. Sitting in a meeting, listening to someone say, listening to Mary Emma say, "If I'm not the problem, I have no solution. I didn't know that and didn't know I didn't know it." When she said it, I didn't say, "Oh, isn't that cute? I'm going to write that down." My soul just went, "Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah." It got to my knower. It got to my knower. Okay? So most of us don't believe the sixth step. Most of us don't believe that we're at the profound level that we did when we came into Alcoholics Anonymous, that we're powerless. Our pattern is so, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, get at it. Now that you got the answer, now that you got the instructions, now that you got the specific directions. I mean, what the hell? If the book's got the specific directions, what are you missing? Get after it. Go do it. You can't do it. The powerlessness that we address, you can't do it. If you're this... If this is alcoholism, And the lie that we tell ourselves is that we're sober 15 years. Is your alcoholism gone? When I'm sober 7 years, smacking my kids, when I'm sober 7 years, gambling 4 or 5 hours a day, when I'm bouncing checks, I mean, is my alcoholism gone? I don't know if all of that's alcoholism, but a hell of a lot of it is. We had alcoholism in our house in a negative way for a considerable period of time. I'm ashamed of that. I mean, I wish it wasn't quite that way, but that's the way it was. And it wasn't just that way. We had sobriety. We had friends. We had our lives were changing. The ship was turning. It wasn't as if it was all that bad, but it wasn't all that good as you go through that. Okay? So the things that you have to understand, in the fourth and fifth step, you have to understand you did it. You're to blame. You're at fault. You're still that person. We still have the capacity for the problems that we did when we took that fourth step. We still can hurt people. We can still lie. We can still cheat. We can still slap. We can still do. We're still that person. But most of us, because we have a program, our day-to-day experience isn't anywhere near that same person. It's almost as if when someone says, you're not the same person, but we are. Because the process of finding God and the process of changing your life is a process of subtraction, not addition. It's a process of clearing away the impediments. We focus, because that's all we can do, on what we know. But an enormous amount of the problems that we have in this room arise from our subconscious. We're not aware of them. We make up a story. I think the psychological term is confabulation. You know, why did you park the car in the living room? And we start to, you know, explain through a process like we knew what we were doing, or, you know, explain how those two things connect to each other. The mind does that, just like the eye. The eye's got a hole in the middle of the eye and it doesn't see. But the mind is such a computer, it fills in the dark spot. And that's what the mind does. The mind constructs explanations for the unexplainable through the process of confabulation. That healing that takes place sometimes in psychotherapy and sometimes in meditation, I think happens in the cumulative experience in Alcoholics Anonymous through the hundreds of meetings, through my listening to you when you've lost a child, my listening to you when you've lost a husband, my listening to you when you've lost your job, my listening to you when you have had cancer. I listen to the nobility, I listen to the forgiveness, I listen to the grace, I look for the change. And I can't explain it. All I can tell you is I've never felt better than in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know more about who I am than in any other room in the world. When I bring my damp log to the bonfire of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I have to do on occasion, it's just healing, is what it is. And what I have come to know, and when I say, someone said, what's the biggest issue you see with people who have been around a while that are really struggling? And we all get periods where, I mean, life happens. You get, you know, your marriage is in a tough place, or what, life happens. But a lot of us struggle on a chronic basis, not just an acute basis. We have, over a period of time, we're not as happy as we should be, and we're not as, it doesn't feel as, I feel like I'm not getting the whole thing. And I think the people that I sponsor a number of men who have been around a while, and almost automatically they go back to the steps. And I'm going to go through the steps again. I'm going to do another 4 and 5. I'm saying, well, 4 and 5. Are you missing any information? Is the problem new? I mean, the problems that most of us have are, you know, if you're 50, they're, you know, 15 or 20 or 30 or 40 years old. They're not months old. You know, And most of us have a way that we don't want to show them to ourselves. Or we're so caught up in our identity that we are unwilling to look at anything that would alter our perception of that identity. Without realizing that, you, for God's sake, you altered your alcoholism. On the other side of that wall was a freedom and a joy and an energy that you couldn't have described. And to do that, you had to die. You had to give it up. What do you think's on the other side of your anger? What do you think's on the other side of your pornography? What do you think's the other side of your gambling? What do you think's the other side of your, you know, that same energy, that same power? How does that happen? It happens in 6 and 7. One of the last guys I read on 6, not AA, but a guy who's, I don't think he's AA. I think he's in the program in some way, but I'm not sure. And he said, look, first of all, you have to own, you can't, any therapist will tell you, you can't change anything you don't accept that you have. So the first thing is just tell the truth about it. The hardest thing in the world for me was our son Peter. My son Peter looks like they let the air out of me. He's the most like me of our three children. And he was the most difficult for me to be around. I disapproved of Peter. Guess who I was really disapproving of? Okay. And I took my old man. My old man and I had a... My dad was pretty physical with me, and I just reversed roles. And I became Norb, my father. And Peter became Bob. Hard for me to talk about. Through many of the formative years prior to my dealing with that issue, I would tell you about Peter being arrested. I would tell you about Peter being thrown out of school. I would tell you about his cracking up the car with the money-spending machine that he is. And one day I realized that if my brother was Peter's father, he wouldn't strike Peter. Where's the problem? If I don't have a problem, there's no solution. Not to do that. I had to use the word abuse. Now, when you're 10 years sober, when you're 15 years sober, that's not an attractive word. It's not a word you'd bring up lightly in the meeting. But I had to say that word to myself. See it or be it. If you don't see it, you are it. We didn't see our alcoholism. We were practicing alcoholic. When we saw it, it raised in our consciousness. We were able to bring it to our consciousness and attend to it with our intention and attention, and bring the tools of the program to it and alter it with God's grace. Own, through the process of inventory, own what's wrong. It isn't good guys and bad guys. I mean, where you're going to get at the end of the journey is where you've always been. What you're looking for, you're looking with. The ox you're looking for, you're riding. There's no place to go. You're going home. You're going to where you've always been. You're just going to drop off what's in the way. The spiritual path is the warrior's path. It's through the fire, not around the fire. The fire is an illusion. Just like, I mean, God, would there have a possibility to have a bigger change in our alcoholism being healed? And when Bill talks about it time and time again, he talks about his experiencing his release. He was given a complete release when he talks about step one in the 12 and 12. Why wasn't he given a release, a complete? He doesn't talk about when I got sober, when I took my last drink. He talks about, and so did Lois, when I experienced my release. So how does the change take place? First of all, owning it, labeling it. Tell the truth to yourself. Tell the truth to another person. Tell the truth to God. And then this guy says, do nothing. Until you're entirely ready. Because you can't do it. If we really understood that we can't do it, and that doing nothing was actually doing something, that not doing in the Zen world is considered much higher than doing, that this isn't a process of doing, what do? It's a process of being, how do I be? And be in not doing until you're entirely ready to have God remove the defective character. Thank you.